Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. We're in the middle of February 2018. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. First and foremost, I ask that you donate to my work here. Not only, are there lots of financial problems that I'm suffering with, but also I'm a full-time researcher. My quality is unsurpassed. It doesn't come from nowhere. University professors who are my competition have four or five graduate assistants, depending on how large university is, two or three secretaries, and of course, if they deign to teach undergraduates, all of their papers. People kind of wonder where, the concept of a student doing a paper came from, the idea that he gets free research. That's why it's usually standardized on one topic. These professors do very little work. I have no research institute or anything like that supporting me. I will not claim a tax exemption. So, I rely on you guys. I know my quality is unsurpassed because it's copied so often that my work on Putin and Russia, theology, has worked itself out historically today, is becoming the norm in nationalist circles all over the place. And I was the first one to develop that. So I ask your assistance, please. As always, every penny goes to this work. When someone donates to me, that's God's money, not mine. And I take it very seriously. For those of you who have, I thank you very much. And for those whose emails I haven't gotten to yet, I get a lot of them. I want to respond to everybody. I often simply don't have the time or the energy, especially the last few years, to deal. So it's nothing personal. So I ask your indulgence there as well. That's the first preface. The second preface is something that's going on at my alma mater that has got me extremely upset. I got my doctoral degree and taught for a little while at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. I received two fellowships to attend there, and so my way was paid, and that's how I ended up in Lincoln, which is not something I regret. But there's a student there named Dan Cleave, who was thought to be a member of National Vanguard, but he claims that he's not a member. I'm not entirely sure what happened, but he stated a few non-PC statements to a few of his friends, and now the campus is in an utter uproar. He hasn't been able to go on campus for the last couple of weeks. He's a scientist, a biologist. The basketball team has condemned him and has worn t-shirts their last game, condemning him. The university is having regular meetings to know what to do with this guy. I'm sure the death threats are constant. He's a friend of mine. I've been speaking to him, especially since I'm an alum, a high-ranking alum. I've reached out to him. I've sent a letter to the campus newspaper, the Daily Nebraskan, and it's a twisted and bizarre thing. I mean, this is one kid on campus, and they are behaving like, a column of Panzer tanks has entered the city. They're in terror. This kid is not, he's in the sciences. What he said isn't all that, big of a deal. There's no violence. There's nothing even remotely close to that. Of course, there certainly is against him. But this young man is being tortured on a daily basis. His education is interrupted. His family is crushed. He's a tough kid, I've got to tell you that. I've been through that. I was at the University of Hartford, and there was no internet. I was all by myself. And I know how he feels. When the regime says they're finished with you, they're finished with you. Now, they can't get rid of a kid because of pure ideology. The campus newspaper has been publishing things that, you know, left-wing students just say, oh, he threatened me. You know, all of a sudden, you know, they're flooded with these things. And the campus is, there have been numerous student protests against him. They're demanding his expulsion. And he's not even a member of the group. Now, when I was at Nebraska, I was in both political science and philosophy. I was quite vocal, and nothing like this occurred. I mean, there were professors who wanted me out, David Forsyth in particular, and they really tried to mess with my, but, you know, very little you can, when you're a nice student, you're doing very well, there's nothing they can do. I can't imagine what would have been done today. This student's face, they try to make sure it's a close-up in the student newspaper every week. It's been in Newsweek. It's been in Time magazine. They're claiming that he's violent, but, you know, obviously he hasn't done anything. The entire campus is in an uproar, and they want him out. They want him to take online classes, which I don't know how you can do with labs and things. And the only thing I could ask of you to do is to contact the university. And very rationally and calmly protest this. They would love nothing more than for you to, you know, rant and rave. There's a Jewish student on campus who says that he doesn't want to come on campus anymore because he's frightened. And I think the letter was so bad that I think he wants a violent response from our people. Because anything that happens will be blamed on poor Dan. And this Jewish student says that, yes, the Fourth Reich has arrived with this guy. I mean, the neurosis, the obsession with destroying him now is new to me. It's definitely a post-Charlottesville thing, but they're going on all eight cylinders here against this kid. The kid hasn't done anything. He hasn't said anything. He's a friendly kid. I mean, he has no problem with anyone on campus. He's just a normal guy. But because he once said something positive about National Vanguard, there is an ongoing university-sponsored, elite-sponsored attack on him to destroy him, his family, and to get him out of the university. These people want to talk about McCarthyism. McCarthy didn't have the power to do anything to anybody. And of course, he was right. But this is 1,000 times worse. They do have the power to destroy this guy. I'm speaking with him on a regular basis. He's hanging in there. He's handling it better than I did. I've contacted both the University of Nebraska Alumni Association and numerous institutions, and my status there as an alumni, as an alumnus, really is, it means something. But it's got me very, very upset that even the slightest interest in the nationalist movement of a student on campus, even if his work is totally non-political, will lead to this massive national public humiliation. They're inventing all kinds of stories. Fake news. Every article has a new charge against him. All made up stuff. And I can imagine. I mean, I went through it, and it wasn't as bad as this because you didn't have the internet back then. Now, when this kid goes back on campus again, what's going to happen? This really is moral support at this stage, is what Daniel needs. That's the second preface. Last week on the Daily Nationalist, I spoke about the Polish economic miracle. And since then, I've been in depth researching it. I am embarrassed to say that this really hasn't been on my radar screen. Russophiles and Ukrainophiles don't worry too much about Poland. And yet this country and government has stepped up in a huge way. What we've done on this radio show, these lectures, is to show theology in motion. That politics and philosophy is always theological. This is how God manifests his will over time. God and the ideas exist outside of time. History is how they manifest themselves in time. And there's a connection, of course, between the victories of the nationalist government in Poland and what's happening to people like Daniel Cleave, is that we're winning. And in fact, we're winning all over the place. The same treatment of Daniel, University of Nebraska campus, is the same that's happening in the international press to the Polish government. The same made-up stories, the same inventions, and I've been reading pretty much everything I could get my hands on in English on the Polish question, and they have no idea why this government is so popular. They're trying to explain it and using those bizarre theories. All their predictions, of course, as always, fail. And here you have a major economic success. It's not being talked about in the press. It's not discussed in academics. Now, here's a country that had some version of so-called shock therapy, which is, you know, mass privatization in a relatively short period of time in the early 90s, but did not have the complete bottoming out of the society like you had in Ukraine, like you had in Russia in the 1990s, most places in the 90s, with the exception of Belarus. The international press is so tightly controlled that the reasons for this success are simply not being discussed. It's a huge story. Poland is the only country that grew during the 2008 currency crisis, 2007-2008. As Greece and Portugal and Ireland are completely bankrupt, Poland is growing. And of course, nationalism is at the very root. But since they can't say that, academics and journalists are inventing things that, you know, they're, I guess, very creative. You know, it's kind of like in the Swedish case. Why has there been a spike of rapes over the last 5 years? Establishment journalists, their explanations for this, to avoid blaming it on the migrants, really, at least it's funny that women are louder these days, that men can't handle female liberation just in the last 5 years, that they changed the law, so everything is rape. I mean, this is what they're willing to say. It's pure cognitive dissonance. It's an unenviable position for these people to be in. But in general, as far as Poland goes, they have simply ignored it. You see the same in South Africa. When, you know, when I was in early college, the early 90s, Poland was on the front page every, South Africa was in the front page every day. It was the cause. And then in the de Klerk removal of apartheid, and suddenly it disappeared. No one is talking about it. It is nowhere. And we know the answer to that. Why is that? It's because there was a Jewish takeover of the government. Most of the cabinet ministers early on were Jewish. Privatization of the bank and the destruction of apartheid meant that now South Africa is a fifth world country. All of its infrastructure destroyed. And it's one of the highest crime, it's one of the crime capital of Africa, which is saying something. Well, just like in that case, they're simply ignoring the Polish case. The big question is, and the question that no one's asking, is, or if they do ask it, it's a disaster, is why did Poland not go the way of Russia or Ukraine in the 1990s? Ukraine is still going through it. Just like every other place in the Eastern Bloc, state enterprises were privatized, prices were freed, the bank given over to Western bankers. And of course, the result is mass unemployment, mass inflation, shortages far worse than anything they had under Marxism, the complete destruction of the economy. And the theory was that only it's going to last a short time, then we can recover. Now, in the Russian case, It was only because those guys get thrown out under Putin that they recovered. In Belarus, it only happened partway, and then Lukashenko had come in and stopped it. And Poland, this whole time, has come in under the radar. The only reason it's being discussed at all is because, as most of you know, Poland is refusing to let in these hordes of invaders called migrants. There's a quota that the EU is forcing on them. Hungary and Poland are in that same position. Now, Hungary and Poland being a member of the European Union is laughable because prior to that, membership in the EU was very difficult because you had to have a certain type of economy, a certain type of accounting system. You had to have a certain level of a certain legal structure in place, low debt and all this stuff. Of course, now no one in Europe can match. Poland and Hungary didn't come close to EU standards. But in order to keep it away from the customs union, they dragged it right in. Same thing for Bulgaria. The standards for EU membership were thrown out the window, and these countries were brought in solely for the sake of control. And you have commentators. You know, these are academics and journalists. These are the opinion leaders of the Western world who, of course, you know, none of these people are objective. No university is an objective scientific institution. No major newspaper is an objective scientific institution. These are pillars of the left-wing globalist movement. They're partisans. New York Times said as much during the Trump campaign. So you can't expect objectivity from them. You read the New York Times, what do you expect to get? They don't even make a pretense of objectivity anymore. They function because people still think that they have some ethics and that they're going to follow some objective. No, that's never been the case. They don't see themselves that way. That's not what they are. An academic to the worst. Academic to the worst because you have massive belt tightening all over the place. And these guys are making $500,000 a year and doing no work and getting tons of tax money, you know, especially for a state university. But most universities are state or federal because of not just being financed by the state, but most of the students are coming in with federal loans. And I guess they're hoping that no one notices that these guys are getting a huge amount of money for nothing. Their predictions are always false. They're intensely corrupt. And they're immensely ignorant. I was in academia for a very long time, and I know precisely how these people are. So what's the answer to the question? Poland and Ukraine went through the exact same process of privatization at the same time. Ukraine is a fourth world backwater today, unfortunately, and Poland is a first world economy. What happened? Well, what happened is the reason why it's not in the papers very much. Today, the condemnations of Poland are vicious because they're refusing to let in migrants. Now, it just so happens that the Poles have let in thousands of Ukrainian, actual refugees from the war in eastern Ukraine. But that's not what they mean. The migrants can't be white. I mean, the EU is being blatant about this. No, it's the non-white migrants that matter. That's what you have to do. Now, Poland is well beyond their quota in bringing in Ukrainians and fleeing the war. But they don't form a phalanx of military-age males. Their family, you know, elderly and everything else, which is costing the Polish government quite a bit of money. That doesn't count, the EU says. We're talking about non-white migrants. Proving, of course, that this is really about destruction of national economies. But the quick answer to the answer why did Poland not go the route of Ukraine is, first of all, the Germans kind of took Poland under their wing. The German economy really buttressed and stabilized the Polish one. They're by far the number one trade partner, both in exports and imports. and because of their, you know, proximity, it was very important for Germany to have a stable Poland. Number two, there's a tremendous ethno-religious nationalism there, coming from the anti-communist struggle, both Roman Catholic and Polish, which, you know, from time immemorial have been one and the same thing. To be Polish is to be Catholic. This was the polemics in Ukraine between Uniates and Orthodox and Roman Catholic at the time, in the early modern era, was ethnic. To be Ukrainian was to be Orthodox. To be Polish was to be Catholic. This identity coming from the and growing in the post-communist era has been able to develop very rapidly and become manifest very early on because it was shielded from Western consumerism. Some of you may have heard Independence Day last year, November, you had almost 100,000 nationalists, I mean, our people, rallying in the capital with the full support of the government, and the government is praising them and assisting them. And, of course, all the press talked about was the counter-protesters, of which there were a handful, all from foreign organizations that had to be protected by an army of cops. Their signs were all in English, as always. Any protests now, you have some protests that are developing in Poland, even though the economy is exploding and everyone is doing incredibly well. According to Gallup, over 80% of Poles are happy with their life, or very happy with their life. But because of the anti-migrant notion, George Soros is financing protests there. They're very small. And none of these are actually Polish by any means. And number three, the last one, is that although this was not covered in any newspaper article, even at the time, the state retained control of most strategic industries. Coal and steel, a lot of foreign trade, heavy industries of all types remained under state control. This is why Poland didn't go the route of Ukraine. It wasn't privatized in the same way. So every once in a while, you'll read in like the Financial Times or something, they'll say, well, they had the same treatment in the early 90s. Why are they so different? And of course, they can't answer the question, and they don't answer the question. You know, I read 100 articles on this from mainstream media sources, and they don't answer the question. They don't know how. But 2013, industrial output is 2.5 times what it was in 1989. And you have about the same, 2.5 times the GDP of Poland than it was in 1989. Ukraine is, you know, is a shadow of what it was in 1989. Belarus has reached that level. Russia has reached that level. But Ukraine is, it's hard to get accurate statistics, but it doesn't have a functional economy. Poland has grown substantially since 1992. Now, I mentioned that Germany has kind of taken the country under its wing, and that's true. But I want to stress that only 10% of this growth is foreign. In 2013, Poland has about 65% of Western Europe's per capita GDP with a much lower cost of living. I mentioned the happiness factor. There's been a number of polls over the last 5 years or so measuring how you could go up into Gallup's organization and you could see your Levada Center. And they have all kinds of things like this, you know, their attitude, their confidence in the country, their confidence in the future. And Poland is far and away the happiest country in Europe. And it's getting better. And it also has a government that is extremely popular. I've actually read, and I can't believe I'm saying this. You know, if you Google something like the popularity of the Polish government, you'll get article after article. Why is this government so popular? We don't understand it. They're illiberal. They're nationalist. We know they can't really be popular, but they are. The BBC recently wrote, the first line was, the Polish government has come under vicious attack from its political opponents due to its anti-migrant policy. Well, that's what political opponents do. What kind of a stupid thing is that to say? Of course you come under attack from your opponents. But there's no one else you're coming under attack from except for you guys. Democracy equals liberalism in the American sense of the term. To be democratic is to have full abortion and fag dominance and affirmative action and migrants everywhere into, you know, low birth rate, you know, secularization and official atheism. This is what democracy is. When they use the term, any newspaper uses the term, that's what they mean. And I said this many times before. They say that Poland has now taken an anti-democratic turn. Well, using the term the way they're using it, it's certainly true. But that's not what most people think democracy is. The government's most popular in post-communist Polish history. It wins every election it touches. These guys don't even have to campaign. It was just a few years ago, I read the Washington Times that said there is not a single leftist in the Polish Sejm or parliament. Not one. I think it's very important. You know, when Pope John Paul II was elected in 1978-79, I think the Soviets were very upset. Poland was always the weak link in the Warsaw Pact. And to have the upsurge in Catholic nationalism with the Pope, now that's Polish, and very interested in affairs there, there's no doubt that that's one of the things that got these dominoes falling. You know, I have nothing to say with the theology, of course, we disagree with, but as a sociological foundation, it's been politically extraordinary. And you see this throughout Eastern Europe. These successful countries, and you see this everywhere, actually, not just in Europe, but countries that are economically successful, especially small ones in tough times, are always those that follow nationalist policies and have a very strong religious factor that the state supports and is a part of. If you remember a few years ago, the French, this is prior to the migrant crisis, there were violent protests throughout France because the government there was constantly increasing the retirement age. They're trying to avoid paying pensions. And I think now the retirement age is 71. And some of these protests became violent because you had politicians talking about eliminating these pensions altogether. We simply can't afford them. Well, Poland has lowered. They're so awash with tax money that they have lowered the retirement age, which is 60 for women. Throughout privatization, throughout the 90s, there was no removal of its social safety net. The infrastructure of social services was never destroyed. Now, the Harvard University IMF plan was to destroy all of this. So eliminate the communist state, sell off all the assets, privatize the bank, and let things fall where they may, which, of course, was utter and absolute destruction in Ukraine and Russia. The Poles said absolutely not. The Belarusians said absolutely not. Many industries remain under state control, which is absolutely key. And we get to the bank here in a minute. Even still, today, the private sector is 80% of the economy. 20% of the economy is firmly in state hands, and that is your more strategic resources and heavy industry. The best part now, and this has only been enacted in 2016, is the Family 500 Plus program. This is the main reason that Poland's under vicious, inhuman attack. The whole argument about bringing these migrants in is that you're losing population. So they have to be replaced by these third worlders, who really are patriotic Poles. The Poles said, no, we're just going to increase the birth rate. And so there's a very large subsidy paid for a family that decides to have their second child, and then their third, and then their fourth, and it's a large payment. The work that's been done since 2016, so it says a lot about the Polish population, that they are using it for necessities. They're taking this very seriously. The family has to be a unit. It has to be their second child, and it's not means-tested. It doesn't matter how wealthy you are, you get the subsidy. And everyone gets the same one. Child poverty went down by two-thirds within 2 years, up until, I say, you know, today. Growth did not occur at the expense of the poor. Like in a lot of the other countries we've covered in this show, foreign direct investment, or FDI, was not encouraged. That which exists comes from Germany. But like we in South Korea, a nationalist government is going to want loans from abroad, not investment from abroad. But Germany is too essential for Poland's growth for that to be the case, at least in the German case. But it's highly limited. And you have these libertarian groups like the Heritage Foundation condemning Poland for making it very difficult for a foreigner to invest in the country, especially in land. The family program has earned the ire of the global elite and the global media. It's precisely because of this program. Now, of course, families are having children. Now they can afford it. And now they don't need migrants. The rage you hear from these people, the hysterical, neurotic ranting, like against Dan Cleave in Nebraska, that the Fourth Reich has arrived in Lincoln, the Fourth Reich has arrived in Poland. As you know, the President Duda just signed a bill criminalizing implication Polish national movements in the Holocaust during the Third Reich. Now, I don't know why the state is involved. Putin's done it with the Red Army. I don't know why they're doing it, except in this case, this is a way to give the finger to the global elite. You will not slander us. You will not use the Holocaust to destroy the Polish national movement. And therefore, if you try to implicate it, you will go to jail. So at least in that particular case, it isn't so much, you know, attacking the Polish record in World War II. It's the use of subversive propaganda, which is all foreign financed. The Polish population, as we've said, is prosperous and happy. Growth is extraordinary. The government is naturally very, very popular. But according to the regime, it is anti-democratic. The government is trying to take over the media, they say. Because the only people who can control the media in the Western sense is large corporations. There is no such thing as an independent media unless it is a local level entity where, you know, writers and journalists are, you know, actually owners of the capital. Media is a corporate entity. Corporations are more powerful than governments. So if a government controls the press, or a conglomerate controls the press, you have the same problem. In neither case is it independent. Now, I read government-owned press all the time in Syria and Russia, and they are quite thorough in their criticisms of the government. State-owned press in Russia can be very against Putin, can be very against Assad in Syria. It is not just some propaganda outlet. You only see that in privately owned press. There is complete independence. Even if the state owns it, there is far more independence for journalists than you have under corporate rule. So already the U.S. is talking about regime change. When I say the U.S., I'm talking about the elites in the State Department and, of course, in major corporations. As I've said before, one of the main elements of the migrant invasion, one element is to drive down wages. It's not the only thing, but it's a very important thing. The French minister of, I believe, the minister of the Treasury, a few years ago, I mentioned on this show before, or maybe it was a Daily Nationalist, I can't remember, said that we need to dismantle the minimum wage. We need to destroy the minimum wage system so that corporations can hire migrants at lower prices. At least they're working in that case. Now, that story wasn't followed up on. It was admitting way too much. So under the guise of getting migrants at least occupied and getting them a head start in the system, we need to destroy the minimum wage, eliminate it entirely. Even if they're working for a couple of dollars an hour, it's better than being totally jobless. This is what the Poles are rebelling against. Now, given the fact that Germany is so invested, in all senses of the term, in the Polish economy, despite Merkel's failed policies in this respect, German capital is going to demand a hands-off policy. Now, I could be wrong here. German capital may be, demanding multiculturalism, but they would be lunatics to do so because they're doing very well there. The internal Polish market is growing rapidly. Poland is on its way for, tremendous self-sufficiency. Fast growth economies in Asia, they always struggle with the internal market. The internal market is the last thing to develop in an economy. But Poland said, no, it's going to develop just like everything else will. Germany has made its separate, when I say Germany, I mean German capital, has made separate pieces with Russia many times in energy and everything else. They flout the sanctions. They do it all the time. Energy companies especially are doing it. Certain smaller banks are doing it. They flout the sanctions because if you want to go after one of these huge corporations, first of all, it's very hard to do. It's going to be a long court case. And in the course of the trial, lots of nasty things are going to show up in testimony. And lots of things that the government doesn't want in the public eye are going to be brought up by the capitalist entity that's on trial. So in many ways, flouting the sanctions is pretty easy, especially if there's tons of money to be made. The Germans have done this with Belarus for the last 15 years or more. There's been sanctions on Belarus for a long time for the same reason that there are on Poland. But because the internal market is doing very well, the economy is doing very well, disposable income continues to rise. Even in the late 90s, German capital have invested there and is doing very well there. And they simply ignore the sanctions. Now, of course, capital is always liberal. Capital always demands chaos. But they also demand profits. A capitalist entity will condemn Putin's nationalism on the one hand and invest $1 billion in his country on the other hand. That's how it's been for a long time. And so their public pronouncements are meaningless. That's PR. More importantly, because they make money there, they'll try to satisfy the state as much as humanly possible. But when it comes down to it, they're doing well. In both Belarus and Poland, the internal market is growing, and this is something that's relatively new. You don't see this in the Asian tigers or other developing economies. It's a matter of policy. You can't have this lopsided development, and capitalists do real well before, and everything is based on exports. So the internal market is neglected. That's not the case. And because of this firm sense of national identity, you have a tremendous level of cooperation and social trust. One of the reasons, and now we get to yet another reason, the fourth reason why Germany, I'm sorry, that Poland didn't go the way of Ukraine, is its very powerful labor unions. You know, Solidarity was the vehicle against the Soviet, pro-Soviet government of Jaruzelski in the 1980s. Strong unions like this talk about a strong level of trust among individuals. Well, you can't have a strong level of trust unless you have a homogeneous culture. Because to trust one another, you have to have a basic general agreement on civic life. You have to speak the same language. You have to have the same moral code in the most general sense. Then you could trust one another. Then cooperation becomes second nature. It's a very important reason why the migrants and the immigrants are so important to capital and to the left and neocons in general, because it will destroy the social trust. You're afraid to say anything because you don't know if you're going to offend somebody. You could lose your job and more for an innocent comment. Same thing goes for gender relations. Anything can happen to anybody in America. A man in America is not safe with his property. He could be despoiled of his property at any time if the woman says so. After VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, that's how it is. You don't see this in the West. And I'll say this again. It's very important to note that being under the Soviet thumb had some positive aspects. And one of the positive aspects was that it guarded these countries from, you know, the hippie movement, from the, you know, drug culture, the rock culture, you know, in a political sense of the term, consumerism, the advertising, the hedonist obsession with sexuality and stuff like that, that has not nearly affected these countries as much as it has the West, where it was born. They were to a great extent, I mean, the Soviet Union, that's, you know, the sexual revolution was seen as decadent. Now, Lenin's people didn't say that, certainly. But the sexual revolution is absolutely essential to postmodern capitalism, because the male sex drive is the most powerful force on the planet. Whoever can harness that will dominate the country. So pornography and, you know, liberalization of laws against all that kind of thing is essential for capitalism to develop a consumer society in the postmodern world. The Catholic Church, although the present Pope of Rome is useless, wants nothing to do with this. As far as Poles, I think, are concerned, John Paul II is still Pope. Because, of course, this present Pope condemns Poland and condemns its migrant policy and has done so before. So when I say Catholicism, I mean its national church. Yet again, the national church being separate from the Rothschild dynasty in Rome. But there's something else too. I said that growth didn't come at the expense of the poor. Poland is showing that not only can an internal market develop at the same time as capital for a small country, that inflation could be brought under control without a private central bank, or at least a central bank that has to follow government dictates. But you can have growth without extreme inequality. The Gini index It's an index between 1 and 100. Where 1 is perfect equality, where everyone has the exact same amount of good. And 100 is extreme inequality, where one person has everything. Now, of course, Okonczyk is going to be in between that. Poland is at 37, which is extremely good, because the United States is almost at 50. That's extremely high. Haiti's at 60, one of the extremely high ones. South Africa is at 60, 55, I believe. Brazil's at 50. Those kind of economies with tremendous inequality. Sweden is 27. Poland is just above that, 10 points above that. And it's actually gone down in recent years. In other words, the prosperity of the country and the growth of the economy doesn't automatically mean an oligarchy is created. There are no Polish oligarchs, at least none that have the power that you have in Ukraine. I want to note that professional economists and academia said none of this was possible. They said this can't happen. Their policies are going to fail. Usually when an American academic economist predicts something, you know they're wrong. These people have been a part of meltdowns all over the world. You know, Andy Schlieffer and Lawrence Summers at Harvard, who were part of not just one meltdown in Russia, but the other one in America, too. These people are amoral, nothing more than spokesmen for capital. As always, every single prediction of establishment economists didn't come true. Today, Poland is the 19th largest economy in the world. When the Family 500 policy was first promoted, all of a sudden you had leftists around the world saying, oh no, we can't have this social welfare program. All of a sudden they're opposed to social welfare. It's too expensive. The problem is, because of the nature of the economy and its growth under German patronage, not to mention a firmly nationalist government, especially recently, taxes have increased as tax rates have gone down. This is the case in the United States in the mid-80s. When the economy grows, regardless, you know, you could lower taxes and have far greater collections if the economy is growing. The Polish government has taken steps to nationalize the central bank. This is absolutely essential. Central bank in Poland is partly owned by foreign investors. However, its president is appointed by the president of the country, and the monetary council is appointed by both the president and the parliament. So they have firm, direct, it doesn't really matter who owns it, they have firm and direct control over it. The Polish central bank has to turn over their books to the CM every year. And they must follow the monetary policy to the government, which in this case have been nothing but successful. One of the things that you're getting in the press, and you're not seeing this often, but in more specialized journals, they'll say how the central bank the central bank's independence is being compromised. Now, independence is it's a propaganda word. It means controlled by major Jewish bankers, especially Rothschild. I want to mention an aside here. That meme that's been going around, there's only three countries left with a non-Rothschild central bank is wrong. No matter how many times I write to these people, it continues. There are many countries with a state-controlled or state-run central bank, as opposed to just Syria, Cuba, and North Korea. Poland is now one. Russia is one. In Central Asia, you have the same problem that you have in Poland, where you have the central bank must follow the monetary policy of the government, not the other way around. All the SCO countries, Iran, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Russia, China, and to an increasing extent, India, have either state-owned or controlled central banks. The Republic of China, Taiwan, has a state-controlled central bank. You see Iceland has a central bank under complete popular control. And this is increasing. You have a public-private hybrid in places like Moldova and Tajikistan. So again, don't listen to that stupid meme. There are plenty of countries now, and it's growing, where you have a non-Rothschild central bank. There is no connection between a privately owned central bank and control over inflation. I could cite to you work after work, study after study. There is nothing good about a privately owned central bank. It doesn't grow the economy. It doesn't protect the currency. And it certainly doesn't protect against inflation. And there's been, you have a lot of elite academics who were told to defend our independence from the state, the population, and it's very hard. They have to fudge the numbers. I've seen actually how they've done this. They've tried to use variables like, if it's independent in a time of recession, it's better than the opposite, or in a certain period of time. There, a private central bank is better. They'll come up with all these control variables to satisfy the people who are paying the bills, because most of the research grants come from the old money foundations. But for the first time, the global left, which is the global regime, there is no distinction, condemned the and yet, are you hearing that the term populist is now a swear word? I used to think that populist was a good thing. If a government is populist, that means popular. But now nationalist, authoritarian, and populist are all thrown together as one very, very terrible clump. And when, you have politicians trying to defend central bank independence, which, by the way, they won't do it in public, they have to say how irresponsible elected governments are, which doesn't make any sense because they're big promoters of democracy. So it's extremely important to see that, when you're an elite academic, when you're an elite journalist, it comes at a price. It comes at a price. You can't be, anything but a lickspittle unless if you want to work there. Now, one argument that the regime uses to describe or to explain Poland's success is that they're a part of the European Union. As a part of the European Union, they get assistance from the European Union funds. And that assistance goes to education, or infrastructure or anything else. Some articles, will just come out and say, thanks to their EU membership, Poland is doing very well. Well, they haven't been EU for very long, and yet their success story is much longer than that. But it begs the question. The IMF and World Bank have given, or the IMF, I should say, and Western governments have given billions to Ukraine for the exact same thing and never saw again. So it's a stupid argument that on the surface it sounds plausible, but if you think about it for more than 2 seconds, it's implausible. The European Union's had nothing to do with it. In fact, Polish economic policies are usually in opposition to the European Union they're nominally a member of. When you have a German patron, you do what you please. Remember, there's a big difference between Angela Merkel, who was a figurehead, and German capitalists invested in Belarus or Russia or Poland. They have very different interests, and given everything that's going on, the government in Germany, they do not have the stomach for a battle with the most powerful capitalist entities, which are probably going to lose. You know, sanctions are only as good as a government's ability to enforce it. If a company's going to make money in Russia, they're going to make money in Russia no matter what. Citibank and American Express are flouting American sanctions by being a part of the mail system, the new credit card system. They're not exactly, you know, crowing about it. But what's the Justice Department going to do? First of all, there's no money. They want to take both Citibank and American Express to court? That would be years and years of brutal legislation. And what's going to, litigation. And endless court cases. And the government will be very much embarrassed because these companies will then bring up all the corruption behind these sanctions and the mentality behind it and who promoted it and who pushed it. In other words, they could do as they please. I want to mention my favorite reason that the world press has come up with as to why this government is so popular. My favorite is BBC. It was on the BBC blog. And it said, well, because Poland was under the Soviet thumb for many, many years, their deference to government power is a matter of habit for them. Therefore, they support the government no matter what it does. That's been my favorite argument trying to rationalize why this government is so popular. They're coming up with the most absurd things. That's the worst. That was the worst one. I don't know who came up with it. It was an unsigned article. I don't want to read it again. But because of the war, they were part of the Warsaw Pact, and it was authoritarian, totalitarian. Poles are just used to saying yes to whatever the government does. And so the government's very popular today. I mean, these are scholars. These are, you know, longtime seasoned journalists and academics writing this crap. This is the price you pay for success in these fields. I've mentioned before that the 500 plus program, the family program, has been very well spent. This has much to do, it wouldn't be the case in America, but a firm national and religious unity in Poland is the only reason for this. In America, God knows what they would do with that extra money. But in Russia, in the Russian case, it's a tax break. But in Poland, it's a straight-up subsidy, and it's being used only for necessities. They're being very rational about this, and it says a lot about the Polish population. You know, Russian nationalist sites usually don't have much to say about Poland. Whether it be pro-Russia or pro-Ukraine or both, we're usually quite anti-Polish. And historically, that's the case. But not today. They've stepped up in a major way. And because of this firm sense of social trust and a firmly nationalist state, they have clamped down on cheating. That companies have to pay what they owe, or they're going to go to jail. Now, it's true that they've closed a lot of loopholes. And the VAT tax, or the value-added tax, the collections are up 23.5% just in the last few years because of this. That's not just economic growth. It hasn't been that much. This is what happens when you have a government at war with corruption. I might want to add, too, the argument from the BBC that Poles support the government out of habit from the old Soviet era also proves that it comes from Russian domination. They figured out a way to get Russian domination in there. Because it was the Warsaw Pact, I mean, the mental gymnastics that these people have to engage in to explain this, and it means they know what the truth is. Poland is going to move, it's a very good move, to full universal health care in 2018. They have the money, and the Polish population has proven itself to be very rational. There's another article. I can't remember the source at the top of my head, but it said that, yes, the Polish government is immensely popular, but we know deep down they hate it. Oh, let me correct an error. I said two-thirds. The Family 500 Plus program eliminated child poverty by one-third, which is still a monstrous improvement, 33% since 2016. That's extremely impressive. So, you know, we Russian nationalists or Ukrainian nationalists have been hard on Poland over the years, and historically they deserve it. But with the polls done here, the full population, not just the government, you know, when this extra money, these subsidies are being used for baby formula and diapers, that would not be the case in America. They've proven themselves to be a highly rational group of people. Poland has stepped up and is at war with the New World Order. Hungary is too. Poland treats the EU and Russia equally. You know, Poland trades fully with Russia. But $10 billion of trade a year, even though they're supposed to be following sanctions, which they never do. So you have a refusal to be anti-Russian. And so they're balancing off both the East and the West. And this is what happens when you have a government free of corruption. And this is what happens, and the most important thing I want you to take from this is that nationalism creates social trust, that we see the other in a stranger. They're not really a stranger. We have the same history, the same language, even the same appearance. We see each other. There are no strangers anymore. The same blood goes through our veins, so to speak. Because of that level of social trust, corruption has been destroyed. Social cooperation is extraordinary, and these subsidies are being used for necessities. Poland has done what all the economists say can't be done. The growth of an internal market, a non-export-driven economy. Everything is internal, based not on foreign direct investment, but foreign loans. Something similar happened in South Korea. The difference in South Korea is that the internal market took a long time to develop, with a great level of equality among its citizens. And the slow clamp down on a so-called independent central bank has a lot to do with this. And so Poland is under attack. And yet there's not much they can do. Not with the profits that the Germans are making. So Poland has done what everyone said was impossible, as always. The economists are always wrong. The journalists are always wrong. But no one ever seems to lose their job. Thank you for listening, my friends. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.